I know people whose families make them use paper plates and plastic silverware, which is completely needless and it has nothing to do with transmission. And when it happens, that person has a really hard time ever feeling like I'm okay.
When people test positive for HIV, that's the beginning of a new journey and a new set of needs, from the emotional and interpersonal, as we just heard, to the really practical and medical. For patients in Kansas City over the last couple of decades, there's a good chance that the KC Care Clinic, which used to be called the KC Free Clinic, has been involved in meeting those needs. Sally Neville has been instrumental in that aspect of the organization's work since 1992, so pretty early in the AIDS epidemic and the medical community's response to it. Now, as she leaves her post, KCUR's Central Standard hosts an exit interview. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm pleased to welcome Sally Neville to the studio. Hi, Sally.
Hi, good morning, Gina. I'm happy to be here.
How is it that an organization that started as kind of a generalized free health clinic became really known as the place in town where people would flock to be tested for HIV?
Well, I think it started with the early days of the epidemic when the clinic was seeing those patients already before the disease even had a name.
Why was that clinic seeing those patients?
I think because it was out of the mainstream, and those patients tended to feel a little safer coming somewhere in this time of unknown and uncertainty and fear. I think they felt comfortable coming to a place that wasn't quite official as a healthcare clinic.
What felt maybe less official about it?
I think that at that time, and this was in the mid-80s, and that was before I was working there, I think at that time it was seen as a grassroots organization. And although we had physicians and nurses who knew what they were doing, it was just seen as more a part of the community, and they'd already been coming there for other services. And so I think they felt comfortable continuing to come there. The clinic got their first official contract to do anything related to HIV in 1986. And that was when the state of Missouri first contracted with any place in the state to do HIV testing. So in 1986 was really the beginning of the building of a comprehensive HIV program with our testing program. And it was an anonymous test site at that time. And I think it's really important to remember that at that time, the fear and the stigma, as the beginning of the program noted, was really important.
Yeah, set the stage for us. I mean, we probably have listeners who were not old enough when all of this was happening, maybe weren't even born, to remember what we didn't know at the time about HIV and AIDS and what the general kind of tenor around that whole discussion was in our community back then.
I think it's really important for folks to be able to remember those times. It was a time of extreme fear. There was this new disease that was infectious that no one knew for sure how it was transmitted. No one had a cause for it. And obviously, there was no treatment for it. And people were dying in droves from this disease. The other thing that was happening was the people that were infected were primarily at that time gay men, and they were seen as being outsiders. And I think in these days of our country viewing a lot of people as outsiders, I think it's really important to remember that that fear and that stigma incredibly influenced the lives of those patients at that time.
How? I mean, did it affect
They
even the
were,
medical care they received?
I don't believe that it affected the medical care. They were evicted from their apartments. They were fired from their jobs. Their families abandoned them. And they were isolated and alone at a time when they had no hope. Medical care at that time, the medical community was just learning about HIV, and we had no treatment. I took care of my first patient with HIV at the VA hospital in Columbia, Missouri in 1986. And at that time, every healthcare person that walked into that patient's room, gowned, gloved, put a mask on, everything that was given to that patient was disposable. And this was a young kid, you know, in his late 20s, who was dying of this disease that had just been identified. And I look back on that, and I remember sitting with him and helping him write his will. This is a 27-year-old kid who didn't have much to give away and knew that he was dying and wanted what was important to him to go to the people that he cared about.
People, I mean, sort of covering themselves to come in contact with this patient, was that something that you saw as necessary at that time as well, or did a part of you suspect that there was no need for it?
By that time, it was a time when the knowledge about HIV was becoming more clear, and we were just beginning to learn that it was a blood-borne pathogen, that it wasn't transmitted from touch or saliva or drinking out of the same cup, that sort of thing. But it took a long time for everyone to become knowledgeable about that and to become comfortable and for policies and procedures to change. And they did, but it just took time.
Talk to me about your own background. I mean, where you grew up and what you grew up wanting to do.
I was born and raised in Terre Haute, Indiana, and no offense to Terre Haute, Indiana, but my one goal in life was to get out of Terre Haute, Indiana. I decided to become a nurse because in high school, I had a job in a hospital, and I was absolutely fascinated by everything that I saw. And so I went to college in my hometown and became a nurse. And then when I graduated, I got on I-70 and drove a day's drive west and ended up in Columbia, Missouri. And there were 7 hospitals there. And I thought, I can probably get a job here. And so I ended up staying there for 16 years. And then I moved to Kansas City in 1990 and took a job on an inpatient AIDS unit at Trinity Lutheran Hospital, which is no longer in existence. It was the only inpatient AIDS unit anywhere in this geographic area.
So how did you ultimately become so passionate, really specifically, about the need for better care surrounding HIV and AIDS?
Well, I think that the fact that I'm a lesbian had a lot to do with that. I knew folks who were infected long before there was any test or diagnosis. And I think I felt a connection to the folks who were being infected. And I felt the connection with the stigma and the fear, and that being faced with the diagnosis of HIV outed them, whether they wanted to be outed or not, isolated them from family, friends, colleagues. And I wanted to make a difference with that.
Can you spell out a little bit more the connection that you felt personally? I mean, you've talked about the different time period we're dealing with when we're talking about what people knew and didn't know about this disease, but what about what people understood and maybe didn't understand about sexual orientation?
Oh, I've never really thought about it quite that way. I think back then, you know, the HIV epidemic really played a role in bringing the issues facing, well, the whole issue of sexual orientation to the forefront. And it also played a role in the lack of government response early on. And I think that the gay rights movement and the HIV movement kind of moved together in terms of bringing the issues to public consciousness. And I just felt, I mean, I wasn't a part of any major activism like that. It was much more of a personal sort of nature at that time. I just felt that these were folks who were dying and being blamed for it, and they didn't deserve to be blamed for it.
Without compromising patient confidentiality, of course. I mean, are there stories from your earliest days doing this work that stand out from you, for you? I mean, conversations or interactions that changed you and left their mark on you?
Yes, there are many. One story, every year there's the annual AIDS walk, and this occurred several years ago, that I was at the AIDS walk and walking around talking to people, and this older gentleman came up to me and said my name and said, "You probably don't remember me, but you took care of my son at Trinity Lutheran Hospital." And the fact is, I didn't remember him. And he told me about his son, and I didn't specifically remember him either. There were so many. But what he said to me, and I don't remember his exact words, impressed upon me the fact that just by being present and just by doing my job, I made a difference to him. And that, what more could I ask for, you know, than to know that I made a difference like that to someone?
Is it sometimes hard, in given the nature of the work, to truly be present at times? I mean, physically, obviously, you're present, but to be really fully present. And I mean, I imagine that mixed in with the kind of intimate care that you have given is a demand for administrative work and just all the other things that everyone in any profession needs to deal with.
I think, obviously, there are times that you're more present than others. But I think when you're engaged in the work that you're doing and you're directly working with patients and their families, I think it's pretty easy to be present at those moments. And particularly at really critical moments in patients' lives and deaths.
Such as? I mean, what are some of those critical moments when we're talking about HIV and AIDS?
Well, I think, first of all, being told that you're HIV positive, even today when it's a treatable illness and there are lots of resources available for patients, being told that you're HIV positive is certainly a critical moment. I think being told that you actually have AIDS rather than just HIV is a critical moment. Being told that you have, that there are treatment available and that treatment is a lifelong endeavor, and learning how to manage that illness and those treatments. Those are critical moments.
Speaking of critical moments, the KC Free Clinic became the KC Care Clinic in 2013 as Obamacare was approaching, and in theory, more of the population would be insured. So the whole free care for the uninsured premise wasn't necessarily going to meet the needs of the low-income community in quite the same way. Can you talk to me about that transition, both for the organization and maybe even for you personally?
Sure. I think the transition was just a natural evolution in our ability to be available for the uninsured and underinsured, and for those who feel estranged from mainstream society. I think it was absolutely necessary for us to make that change. And from a patient perspective, patients still get care, whether they can pay or not. And the culture, you know, of care hasn't changed as a result of becoming a billing organization. You know, part of the requirement of being funded by the federal government is that we don't turn anyone away for the inability to pay. And that's always been our standard, and that hasn't changed.
There was a lot of concern at the time for how the needs of especially the homeless population might either continue to be addressed or maybe not. Has care for Kansas City's homeless population been something that you've seen change in that time, or no?
I don't think I can really address that very well. We have some homeless patients at the clinic, but there are other programs in town that are really focused on providing care for the homeless. But certainly, you know, what we see mostly are not folks who are homeless living on the street, but what in the business we call unstably housed. And a more vernacular term is that they couch surf, meaning that, you know, they stay with this person this week and somebody else next week.
Can you spell out a little more clearly? I mean, you've hinted at it, but what is the relationship between the cost of medical care and the demographics of HIV and AIDS patients? I mean, why is, we've talked about it a little bit, but why is a sliding scale of cost so important for this particular population?
Well, the sliding fee scale enables anyone who doesn't have insurance or has insurance that only kicks in after $5,000 or $10,000. It's important for anyone, regardless of what disease they might have, to be able to access comprehensive primary medical care. The HIV population, there are many programs and there's federal funding that does help provide a number of resources for them. But all patients who are uninsured have the right, in my opinion, to access good medical care.
How are the questions and challenges facing patients different now than they were when you started working with this organization in 1992?
Do you mean for all patients or for HIV patients?
For HIV patients.
HIV patients. Well, I think the huge difference is it's not a terminal illness anymore. It's a long-term chronic illness that is manageable. And so the big issue for patients now is how to integrate that illness into their entire life and how to learn to live well with it for their entire life. People who are diagnosed with HIV today, if they get on antiretroviral treatment and stay on it, they have a normal lifespan. But getting on treatment and staying on it is the hard part. And so those are the questions and the issues that patients with HIV really have to face today.
Is there anything that you think Kansas City needs to do moving forward to be sure that HIV and AIDS patients don't slip through the cracks? I mean, do we have blind spots that need addressing?
Kansas City has a really well-coordinated, comprehensive system of care that's partially funded through the federal government. And that system is a community-based effort and is really pretty strong, and there's a lot of commitment to it. The folks who are kind of slipping through the cracks are among some of the most vulnerable members of our community, and they are among some of the hardest to reach. We have efforts going on in town to reach out to those folks and to provide a wide range of services.
Can you use vulnerable in what way?
Vulnerable in that they may have mental health issues, they may have substance abuse issues, they may be estranged from family and friends, isolated for any number of reasons. And they may be formerly incarcerated, all of the socioeconomic issues that you see. And those folks, working to engage them in care and to retain them in care, takes a whole host of resources and people.
Sally Neville with the KC Care Clinic since 1992. It was an honor to speak with you this morning.
Thank you, Gina. It was an honor to be here.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, the science of ferns, what we thought we knew about these plants, just got turned on its head. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. We're back, this time with ferns. So hold up. Before you decide this is the most boring thing imaginable, just hear me out. Once upon a time, science made a lot of assumptions about these plants and how they reproduce that turned out to be false. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my next guest on KCUR's Central Standard is Chris Hoffler, a scientist from KU's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. He's the guy who took it upon himself to test those assumptions, and he's been painstakingly working to correct the scientific record ever since. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
Your story begins when you were a grad student in the 1970s. What did you see that piqued your curiosity?
At that time, there was scientist at the University of Massachusetts who came up with a way of looking at the genetics of ferns that made them different than other organisms.
Different how?
Different in that they had a life history that could have generated extreme inbreeding, which, as we all know as humans, is a bad thing.
Yeah, this is, I think, why you have to testify that you're not marrying your cousin before you
exactly.
get a marriage
exactly.
certificate.
Because that process brings out any genetic problems that are present in the organism.
So, but why did ferns seem susceptible to inbreeding?
They have a separate portion of their life cycle called the gametophyte that produces the eggs and sperm. And if one of those gametophytes fertilizes itself, it generates a new plant that is 100% inbred.
Okay. So what did we actually know about ferns at this time, and what did we assume we knew about ferns?
We assumed that those gametophytes were, in fact, in nature, fertilizing themselves. We
not
did
just
not
that they
know
had
that.
The theoretical ability to do that.
Correct.
Okay.
But it was impossible at that time to test that hypothesis.
Why was that impossible?
We didn't have the technology to analyze the outcome of fertilization in these tiny little plants that are no bigger than the fingernail on your littlest finger.
So did a part of you just want to leave this alone and be like, man, those fern people really haven't got it all figured out? Or were you just immediately determined to test this yourself?
Well, it was interesting. The process that we use to test this is a process that looks at the protein variants in the organisms. And this was kind of a side project, actually. My main dissertation project was completely different.
What was that about?
I was looking at the evolutionary history of a fern genus and developing a technique to look at the variation across the different lineages within that.
So you say this is totally different, but to someone outside your field of study, you're talking about ferns both times, which actually sounds very similar.
Same organisms, different aspects.
Okay, so, I mean, before we continue with the story of how you challenged the scientific community's assumptions about ferns, I have to ask you why you found ferns so interesting in the first place, because it takes more than a passing curiosity to get deep enough to even know that we didn't know what we thought we knew.
Part of that was serendipity, working with an individual whose main focus was ferns.
Like as a mentor?
As a mentor, yes. The other part of it was me liking slightly offbeat organisms.
And you think of ferns as offbeat?
Most people consider ferns a little bit strange, especially in that they don't have flowers, so we don't really know how they reproduce. In fact, their original name was Cryptogam, which means hidden reproduction. And that has stayed with them through all of this time. And we now know a lot more about that.
Were you into plants even as a kid?
Yes, I was. I grew up in the woodlands and...
The woodlands? What
in
woodlands?
In the Northeast U.S. and spent time in the forest looking at plants. I have a brother who looks at animals. I looked at plants. He'd look up. I'd look down.
When you were looking down at the plants, what were you noticing and thinking about? Do you remember?
I think just the diversity of them, at that time at least, the marvelous flowers that were part of the natural environment.
When I was a kid, I was in that Scholastic Book Club where they send you a random book every month. You know what I'm talking about?
I think I remember that. It's a long time ago.
There's this one book called The Strange Thing That Happened to Alan Brewster. It was the craziest, most awesome book ever. Did you happen to read this book?
No.
Okay. For his science project, this kid named Alan Brewster wants to figure out how to make humans photosynthesize. So his teacher reasonably but very discouragingly tells him that what he wants to do is impossible, so he should do an ant farm instead. But his crazy grandpa tells him not to give up, and long story short, Alan is his own test subject and starts photosynthesizing, like he figures it out. And there's this beautiful illustration of Alan with his head tilted up toward the sun like a plant turning green. It's my iconic image of a plant-loving kid, but also of sort of a young scientist going against what everyone believes is true and possible. Can you relate in any way to Alan's story?
Yeah. When I was a high school student, I decided that it might be possible to use electricity to increase the growth of plants. And I grew grapefruit plants from individual seeds and put electrodes in them. Didn't do anything, but I was encouraged.
What were you encouraged to do?
Investigate, to find out, to solve curiosities.
What did happen when you put electrodes in what, grapefruits?
Grapefruit seedlings, yes. They continued to produce leaves. They didn't grow any faster, as far as I could tell. But I was testing my hypothesis.
And that was exciting enough for you.
Yeah.
Well, So back to ferns.
Yeah.
How did you start testing science's assumptions about them? What was that process like?
The process was to find plants in the natural environment, populations of plants, and analyze their genetics using the protein variants. And that got us closer and closer to the actual genetic code of the organism. And by doing that, we could get a much more precise picture of the genetic diversity in each individual.
How does knowing the genetic diversity tell you how they're reproducing? I mean, it might tell you what the characteristics of another plant involved in that. I mean, I guess that would just tell you whether it's a perfect copy or if it's
you can distinguish mom from dad. And so if mom and dad had exactly the same, if egg and sperm had exactly the same genetic constitution, it would look different than if mom and dad, egg and sperm, had different genetic constitution.
Am I naive to find it sort of surprising that ferns have moms and dads?
I can imagine, yes, that plants aren't supposed to do things that humans do, right? But the fact is, and one of the things that we've discovered is that ferns are not that much different than other plants and, in fact, other organisms in general.
Go on.
In the way that they reproduce.
I mean, do we have things in common with ferns other than that that might surprise us?
Well, they're plants, so they obviously photosynthesize.
And so that's not in common.
That's not something that we do. But they certainly have the same DNA that we do. They have the same genetic system that we do. They have eggs and sperm, just like we do. They reproduce sexually, just like we do. So there's a lot of genetic components that are very similar.
So at what point in this process did you know that you had stumbled on something significant?
I think when we began testing the hypothesis that was there, that had been proposed in the 1970s, and we found out it was wrong.
The hypothesis being that ferns basically
were inbred.
Yeah.
We were able to show that they were, in nature, highly variable.
So you published a paper sort of setting the record straight. What happened then? Did it change everything everyone knew and taught about ferns from that moment on?
That was 1986, and we published a paper that basically said that ferns were – that had genetic variation in populations just like other organisms. It did not, obviously, click in automatically. Changing the textbooks is a long process. They spend a lot of money and a lot of time putting together diagrams that they would like to think are accurate. And in the 1970s, they were doing the best they could.
What do you think that your story says about how we know what we know scientifically and how that changes or doesn't as time marches on?
I think any time that you put together a set of testable hypotheses and you have the tools to test those, you make science move forward. And one of the things that I thank this fellow from the University of Massachusetts with about is that he formulated his opinions as testable hypotheses. He was a true scientist, and that left the door open for testing, and it really propelled the genetics of ferns forward very quickly.
Do you see people putting forth their opinions as hypotheses more generally, or do you see him as, I don't know, in some way unique?
I've talked with him. He's emeritus now, but he's. When he wrote that paper, as he told me, he very consciously cast each of his opinions as hypotheses, knowing that someday he hoped they could be tested.
Why does it matter for, say, someone like me? I have no special scientific ability or knowledge to know what you discovered, how ferns reproduce.
Fern, just discovering new things about the world around us, I think, is what scientists crave. And in that way, we are increasing the knowledge of the world. And those who are scientists are basically designed, if you will, to look at the world as a set of facts that can be assessed and falsified or proven true again.
So when you go to dinner parties, I mean, have you ever, in at any point in this long journey with ferns, have you ever cornered someone to, like, make sure that they know that what they learned about ferns and how they reproduce might just not be true?
I don't think I would be that mean.
But seriously, I mean, this must be a really, like, I mean, this is what you've spent your career doing.
Correct, yes. And in fact, in my teaching, of course, when I talk to students who are learning what is anticipated to be the right facts about ferns, I'm very helpful to them in trying to meet this.
So what's next for you?
Right now, I'm spending a lot of time learning about learning and doing a lot of work in the classroom.
Chris Hoffler with us from KU. Thank you, and keep spreading the word about ferns.
I will certainly do that. Thank you very much.
To conclude this morning's show, we're reviving a holiday tradition, the story of a family's Christmas tape from 1968. I won't spoil it by telling you why it matters. Just listen to it in a minute on KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman.
Oh, you sound so wonderful, kid. You sound so wonderful.
That's Peter Alpo, speaking to his children and nieces and nephews on Christmas Eve in 1968 at his house on 35th and Olive. He recorded his family's entire Christmas Eve celebration on his new gadget, a reel-to-reel tape recorder. The joyful sounds captured on that tape almost 50 years ago captured the imagination of local musician Billy Smith and connected him to the Alpo family in a really unexpected way. It starts with musician and record collector Billy Smith combing thrift stores for records.
I discovered this Magnavox reel-to-reel, which is just your kind of old-school style tape player that has two quarter-inch tape reels to it. And next to that machine, I saw a few tapes there. So as a kind of a part-time musician, I thought it would be a good idea to pick up this thing and maybe record some of my own music. And whenever I took it home, I popped in some brand new batteries and cleaned off the tape heads with some rubbing alcohol. And I popped in the tape and I was about to push record, but I decided, you know, well, maybe I'll see what's on here. When I first pushed play, it was pretty immediate that what I was hearing was a family at Christmas. I always just kind of imagine them in this really warm, cozy house, and I can just see Uncle Peter maybe sitting at a dining room, living room table maybe, and all the kids kind of running around. Uncle Peter's voice immediately popped out as someone who was obviously curating the tape, and he was probably the owner of the tape machine.
Adjust the volume control so that the pointer and the indicator moves up to.
And all of a sudden, some of the kids running around were popping up and saying Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas to each and every one of 68. I wish everyone the happiness throughout the whole year.
Holy mackerel, Andy. That girl's going to be a success in her life.
We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
And as the kids came up and wished Merry Christmas, you could tell Uncle Peter would prompt them a little bit. And also just, he's got an amazing voice where he's singing songs and lamenting with some Dean Martin and other tracks like that.
Everybody loves somebody sometime. And although I know I'm wrong,
something.
I'd break out the tape about every time around Christmas. You know, I'd be sitting at home having this family and their Christmas and my background creating that Christmas energy while I'm wrapping up my own presents for my sisters and my family.
For every boy and every girl to have a child. And every minute, every hour.
Sometimes there would be friends over and I'd be like, you have to listen to this tape, you know, it's just amazing. The music that was coming off the tape was soul and jazz that was of that era. I was a little confused by some of the people that popped up on the tape. There's Uncle Ted Barnett, Big Ted Barnett, who announces Happy New Year from the ballroom above the Hudson River, New York City. So I kind of thought the tape had somehow landed from New York. But then as I really dug in a little bit more and kind of decided to zone in on some of the cues that the kids were saying, I noticed that one of the kids says, hi.
Hello, my name is Michael Apple. I'm in fifth grade. I live at 5729 Garfield. Zip code is 64130. And
I live at 5729 Garfield, which I immediately knew and recognized as a Kansas City address.
I'm pretty smart in school, like I always am. Well, I got a brother named Kenneth and a sister named Jarrah and
Sometimes there would be friends over and I'd be like, you have to listen to this tape, you know, it's just amazing. And every time it got the same reaction, like, oh my God, Billy, you got to find these people. And there were many times that I would punch in the last name Alpo, A-L-P-O, kind of like what I was hearing, like the dog food. And I really ran into walls. So I kind of gave it up after a while and I just kind of let it be what it was for me.
Hi, I'm Sonia Alpo. The little girl that you hear on the tape is me.
Facebook came along and they have this search engine where they'll autofill the last name. So I decided to give it one more college try. I punched in Michael Alpo, A-L-P-O, and Facebook's search engine autofilled U-G-H.
Ask my 22-year-old daughter, Lena, hey, how does this? Why is this guy, do you know him? I mean, why is he wanting friends with me? She's like, Mom, that happens sometimes, it's just Facebook. I'm like, well, that's strange.
And all of a sudden, it just clicked that, oh, wow, you know, there was a Michael Alpo, and then there was Sonia Alpo and other people with the name Alpo that looked like they could be the people that were on the tape.
My cousin had called me, and there's a message, Michael, on my phone, and I'm trying to play it back, and I can't get it to play, so I call him, and he's like, Sonia, you're not going to believe this. And he starts telling me the story about this guy that friended him and that he had found this tape and that he had had it for a while and he wanted to start his own recording. So, he held on to it and held on to it and he tried to find us at one time, I believe. And he was looking under the wrong name, Alpo, A-L-P-O.
I did have some reservations because, yeah, I mean, what was I going to say? Hey, I found this tape and I've been listening to you. But I felt like what I was actually going to offer them was an opportunity to maybe like hear it again. So I just put the question out there. I was just like, hello, you don't know me. And I have a strange question to ask. Do you have any relatives with the last name of Alpo and any siblings with the names James, Kenneth, and Gerald? All the names that I was gathering off the tape. And if so, I wanted to let you know I found a tape of them. I just remember not really expecting a response, but I was hoping.
This is what's really weird, okay? So he's telling me this story. I had just arrived at my parents' house in Tampa because I'm from Missouri, okay? So I drove all the way to Tampa, and Michael's telling me this story as I'm sitting on my in the guest bedroom with my parents. We're all talking, and I'm just screaming. I'm like, what? You're kidding me. Because the weirdest thing is that on the way down to see my parents, I was telling my kids that they had these tapes my dad used to make, but he lost them. and I wish they would have been able to hear it.
This is Kendall Fire Palmer, and a Happy New Year. Merry Christmas. This is Michael Apple. Happy Christmas and Happy New Year, all you guys out there.
You know, this is just some guy randomly reaching out to them on Facebook and telling them, hey, I have this tape of you guys in this private moment at Christmas. And but one by one, Janice Alpo, who married into the Alpo family, told me that her husband recognized the names. I reached out to her and let her know that I had digitized the tape. And I said, could you please play this for your husband? And if it rings a bell, you know, get a hold of me. I'd love to get you back this tape and this tape player. She reached back and she said, yes, my husband recognizes this immediately. This was his Uncle Peter's tape.
So here we are, fast forward to, 12 hours later. We're sitting in my parents' bedroom and my cousin Michael tells me this story. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so intense. So I get back on and I realize that that's him, William.
Sonia had accepted my friend request and I was just like, this is amazing, right? And she's like, oh, this is a blessing. And she happened to just be landing at her parents' home in Florida at Uncle Peter and Susie's. I've pretty much have called him Uncle Peter for the last few years, too.
He's always been full of wisdom and, sincerity, and he's very sensitive to people's feelings.
It's all going well, that everybody's just as happy as they can be, although the family's not as close as they should be. Well, that's family, Some get rich, some get poor. I just happen to get poor. Who knows? But it's been a wonderful Christmas as far as now. And why should I try and change it? Because I'm sure that before everything's over, everyone will get, we'll get together. And that makes me very happy. And as long as I can be happy, and everyone else can be happy, the kids got toys, who cares about the old folks?
Through the night, Uncle Peter, I think, it's getting a little bit buzzed. And there's just a lot of moments and some peaks and valleys of joy. And then also some really tender moments where he's kind of lamenting about family and life and laughter and how laughter is really important. And I think even though it's from 1968, a lot of his ideas, they're pretty timeless. Some people get rich and some people get poor. I just happen to get poor. But what the end of the message really he's talking about is how his family are the people that make him rich.
Let's go into something better now. Let's swing, and I know this is going right. And if it's not going right, you tell me about it, and I'm trying to tell you postage stamp, back due, and who all this kind of stuff, and I don't care. We're going to rock.
Uncle Peter, he's really into the music, and he interjects in the middle of the songs, and
tell mama.
Etta James, he kind of shouts back and retorts, tell mama.
Lay it on mama, baby, and just tell her.
And another track where, he's like, let's get this going,
We listen to the tape and, my dad is just freaking out because, he's extremely private. He doesn't know what's on the tape. He's now, older. And what gets us really crazy is that he found it. He gave it to us at Christmas. And that tape that my dad did was at Christmas. So, you know what I mean?
In some ways, it's probably like my favorite possession that I've ever bought, especially from a thrift store for probably less than $5. But I know that it's theirs. I know that it's it holds a lot of deep meaning to them. And I can still go back to my SoundCloud page and revisit it in some of the same ways.
We were also alive, and there was such innocence and such love and such unity. It wasn't tarnished, it was all, just pure. You know what I mean? It was raw. And that's what is, that's what we all should continue to maintain in our relationship.
I guess we should be thankful for what we got. And I hope that each and everyone is, because I know God knows that I am. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Thanks to the Al Poe family and musician Billy Smith for sharing their story with me back in 2014. We love the story so much that we replay it every year, and we hope you love it too. It'll be online with the rest of this morning's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can pass it around to your friends who need some wintry love. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow is Friday, and it'll be a food show, the last of the year. We're talking about comfort food, a subject that means something different to everyone. So what's your comfort food? And if it's on a Kansas City menu, call and tell us about it tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Ted Hope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.